The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Can you hear okay? So, yes? So, I have one announcement, and that is in Sunday, 2 weeks from today, Insight World Aid will have a presentation about its work and how to be involved. Insight World Aid is a service organization that was born out of our community here as its own nonprofit. Has been involved already with a service project, 2 week project in Cambodia and projects around the Bay Area. And so if you're interested in such things, I think it's at 1 to 3, I think 19th of January. So I'll take the opportunity to welcome you to the new year and to wish you all a good year. It's kind of a ritual of our culture to mark this time of year as the beginning of something new, a new year, and with that to consider a little bit the letting go of the old and the beginning of the new, and to set an intention for the new year. And I think it's a great thing, this idea of starting over. Not be burdened by and carry with us so much of the weight of the past, and kind of start with a kind of fresh start and start anew. There's a kind of freedom to that, and it's kind of possibility of new possibilities with that kind of attitude. It's a kind of a cultural artifact that we do this because it's the Gregorian calendar doesn't mark any particular important day. January 1st doesn't. There's no cosmological significant. It's just kind of a made-up thing that some, I guess, a bishop Gregorian made up this day, and we've been happily, or not so happily, going along. And if you're not so happy about going along, it's there's a lot of different, and the Bay Area is rich with all these different cultures. And so if you don't like that particular New Year, or you like more of them, or you, or if you you started off this new year, but you didn't like the start, you can get lots of opportunities because there's lots of many different countries have different New Years. There's Chinese New Years and Thai New Years and Indian New Year and all kinds of New Years through the course of the year. So, but it's kind of nice that this new year also marks a little bit here in the northern climates, the beginning of moving towards the light during a period of darkness. And so kind of going ahead into this new life towards the light. And we're fortunate. I think it's a time to consider our good fortune. It's said in Buddhism that it's a very fortunate thing to be born a human being, and that it's good to celebrate and appreciate the good fortune of a human birth. They say it's very rare to be born as a human being. So if you can do this kind of calculation, here's how rare it is. If there is a blind turtle swimming in the middle of the ocean, and once every 100 years it surfaces its head up through the surface of the water, and in that same ocean, if there is a log that has a hole in the middle of the log, the chances of that turtle surfacing once every 100 years its head up through that log hole is the same chances of you being reborn as a human. So it's pretty rare, it says. So congratulations. So here we are. And it's a custom here at IMC that the first talk I give on the first Sunday of the year is on the Four Noble Truths. So I'd like to continue that. And it's a nice talk for the new year because it's a talk that sets the direction for people. Like, this is the intention, this is the orientation for the Buddha Dharma Buddhism has, and it's good to be reminded of that. One of the good things to be reminded as well is that Buddhism does not exist apart from people who practice it. So, I could talk forever about Buddhism, but there's no Buddhism in my talking about it any more than you sit at home with an easy chair reading a travel book about a country that you've never been to, the book is not about, it's not the country, right? It's not, so you might never go to that country. Buddhism only exists as a territory we enter into that we abide in if we practice it. And so in the new year, when we talk about Buddhism, we talk about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as the practice that we enter into and set the course. The way that it's come down to us, kind of the lore of Buddhism, is that the first teachings the Buddha gave after his awakening was the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And whether that's really the case or not, there's some doubt, but it's a nice myth, at least, that this is what he began to teach. And it was his attempt to try to not just explain, but not more than explain, but to describe a means, a way for other people to experience the same thing he experienced on the night of his awakening. So it was his travel book, in a sense, that if we travel, if we go to that territory, go to that country, then you have a chance of experiencing what he experienced, the freedom that he had. And so so this is what, you know, those first teachings. So it begins with the four, what's called the Four Noble Truths. And as truths, they're not philosophical truths, but again, they're truths about traveling in this territory. How to find the territory and how to travel it. And it begins by emphasizing what in Pali, the ancient language, is called dukkha. And dukkha has most commonly been translated into English as suffering, though it might not be the best translation. Some people have translated it as stress. A common translation is unsatisfactoriness. But what's nice about unsatisfactoriness, maybe more than stress, maybe more so maybe than suffering, is that unsatisfactoriness is seen as an evaluation that we make of a situation. And so it's kind of easier to see that we have some role to play in evaluating something as unsatisfactory. And from a different frame of reference, different perspective, something might be quite satisfactory. Something which is an unfortunate challenge while you're having it and you wish you didn't have it, a year later you look back and say that you're a better person because of that. And it was quite fortunate that you went through that challenge. It was satisfactory in a certain way. So you kind of re-evaluate things different ways. And the importance of this is that whatever the Buddha meant by dukkha, it is pointing to something inside of ourselves, something that we're doing, some activity of mind or heart that is not fixed, is not stuck, is not this is how it has to be, but some inner activity of mind that we have some ability to change, and we can change it radically so that the dukkha is no longer there for us. So the feeling or the sense or the valuation that things are unsatisfactory doesn't impinge on us and limit our inner freedom. The sense of stress is not there, so that doesn't cover over our capacity for being profoundly at ease or at home. That the suffering that our mind kind of conjures up and lives in doesn't have to be there to cover over our tremendous capacity for happiness and well-being. And so the Four Noble Truths begins by a very simple statement for the first noble truth. And that is that there is suffering. Another way of saying it is that, or there is dukkha. Another way of saying it is that in this world that we live in, we will have suffering. There's the experience of suffering. It does not say that everything is suffering, that life is suffering. It's basically saying that there will be, or there is, in this whole kaleidoscope of experience that we have as human beings, part of that will be suffering. Some people experience a lot of it, some people not as much. But everyone will experience it sooner or later, unless you're free. So that's just an honest, meant to be an honest, grown-up recognition of the human condition. And some people find it such a relief to come into a body of teachings and practices where the challenge of life, the difficulties, the suffering, is not prettied over, is not avoided or denied. There isn't kind of a romantic idea that, or some idea that, oh yes, it's bad enough here, but in a future life things will be better, or things aren't so bad because, I don't know, there are rainbows and everything is okay. But a kind of honest, direct kind of willingness to say, when there's suffering here, let's look at it, let's be with it, let's recognize it. So that's kind of the beginning, is that kind of honesty. And the second noble truth is about the usually is described as the origination or the cause or the conditions out of which that suffering, that dukkha, that stress arises. And here again, the fingers are pointing back to ourselves. And over again, for the purposes of freedom, inner personal psychological freedom, the arrow is pointing to us, as opposed to pointing it outside. Now we're not caught up in blaming anyone else. We're not caught up in assuming other people are responsible for our happiness or unhappiness. They might have a role to play, but if we're caught up in externalizing the conditions for it, the causes of it, it blinds us, can blind us to our role. And the whole task of Buddhism is not to deny the role other people have, the responsibility for what they do, but that's not where a path of freedom is found. That's only where a path of relief is found. You can get get people off your back, and it's a relief. But to really kind of find the path, you have to kind of be willing to do this very radical thing. It's very radical to turn 180 degrees and really look deep inside and see what are you doing? What's going on here? And so the cause of suffering is described with a word in Pali said tanna. And tanna seems to be a common ancient word for thirst. And so we think of thirst or like hunger, that you're really thirsty. There's kind of a drive, a need, a push for something. The thirst for power, the thirst for money, the thirst for something. And it's more than, it's almost addictive in quality. And it's compulsive. Something has taken over, something takes over, and we're kind of, there's a momentum, a force within us that's driving us. Another word that I like for this thirst that's often used is craving. Because craving is not just a desire, it's desire where there's compulsion and or drivenness behind it. Compulsion and drivenness means that it takes over and we don't have so much choice. We can't just let go of it easily because it has a power of its own. And so to tell people, that you're responsible for your suffering and you just have to let go of your thirst, it's kind of a disservice to them because of how, it's a compulsion or drivenness, addiction, attachment, which is we're often very strongly connected to, identified with. And so it's hard to let go of some of the deeper things. It's easy to let go of small things, but some deep things is hard. The way the description of the second noble truth is classically given is that thirst is connected to delight in existence. Delight in, certain kind of delight and pleasure that we want. I think the assumption is that human beings are often driven by a drive for some kind of pleasure, satisfaction, and some kind of delight. And so many things we do is in the pursuit of that. And that can be quite powerful, quite intense. And I think one of the strongest representations of this kind of thirst and drive and compulsion and drive for pleasure is a sexual drive. I mean, very intense, right? A few of you, maybe when you were teenagers, can remember how strong that drive can be. And And so what does it take, if that's really what causes the suffering, what does it take to attain the third noble truth, which is the truth that it's possible to bring a cessation of the suffering caused by craving? That's the third noble. That's not kind of like the good news in Buddhism. And because it's not easy, then there's the fourth noble truth, which is the path, the eightfold path, to lead to the cessation of that suffering, that craving. And the eightfold path is a comprehensive path of how to develop your character so that your character is tuned or refined or developed, so you have the capacity and the ability to let go in this deep way. Down through the centuries, a very important part of Buddhist practice has been character development. And whether it's developing the perfections, what's called the paramis, or other things, but not just letting ourselves be who we are and say, well, I'm just going to accept myself as I am and just learn to let go. That's nice. But to really develop ourselves or create ourselves or shape ourselves, shape the mind and the heart into such an instrument where it has the ability to see deeply. It has the strength of character that allows us to let go. Because it's frightening to let go. It's frightening to let go of some of the things that, you know, one of the strongest drives of clinging, of craving, has to do with attachment to self, attachment to life. And the idea of letting go of attachments to self, self-identification of all kinds, even the attachment to life seems, some people, impossible, seems ridiculous, seems like very frightening. And so it takes a certain kind of strong inner character, personal strength, to be able to stand up against the edge of that possibility of letting go and know you're going to be okay, have the confidence that it's okay to let go in this deep way. So the Eightfold Path is a comprehensive way of cultivating oneself and developing oneself so that the deep inner work can be done. It begins by the first one of the Eightfolds. They all start with the word right. Eight right ways or factors. And some people get turned off by the idea of right because that's right and wrong. But it's not meant to be right as opposed to wrong in a judgmental way, but rather it's right in the sense of having the right tool for the job. And so, you know, you don't want a screwdriver if what you're doing is, I don't know what, but, you know, it's the... You don't want a jackhammer if what you want to do is to screw in the screw of your or my glasses, right? So you need to a little screwdriver, not a jackhammer. So you want the right tool. So you want the right tool to do this work of freedom. And the first right thing is having the right orientation or the right perspective. Because if you want to study something and find something, accomplish something, you want to look in the right place for it. You can look in the wrong place and you'll miss it entirely. And because Buddhism, the path of freedom that Buddhism is pointing to, or Buddhism, is associated with religions, associated with all kinds of other spiritual traditions, it's very easy for people with a wide range of religious ideas that exist in our world to get confused about where the path really is. I don't know if this is a fair contrast, but I came across some people recently who were really into the power of crystals. And maybe crystals are powerful, I don't know. But you're not going to find that path to freedom and personal cultivation and character development and personal freedom in the crystals. And maybe they're useful. Vitamins might be useful. and maybe vitamins are useful to creating a healthy body that can walk the path. But that's not where the path is found. And so in this complexity of all the different options, you go into a spiritual bookstore, you mean, look at your options of beliefs and ideas, and it's pretty amazing. It's dizzying. And it's not uncommon for, you know, I think for at least, you know, anybody, everyone believes, some must believe something, but to look around and see at some of those beliefs, it's like, geez, how can someone believe that? I think the one of the strengths of Buddhism in this right view is it points us to the most direct perspective, orientation of our lives for understanding freedom from suffering. And the most direct way to do it is to appreciate your suffering, to notice it, to stop for it. The bumper sticker of a Buddhist says, I stop for suffering. Because if you stop for it, to look at it and study it, then you have a chance to understand it more deeply. Then you have a chance to get there to the roots of it. So there's a lot of things you can do that are very nice to do, but they don't help you with your personal investigation. It's not a direct path. So the right first step of the Eightfold Path is right view, it's called, which is to use the perspective, the framework of the Four Noble Truths to understand your life. There are other understandings which are useful to have as well, but for walking the Buddhist path, it's that particular frame of reference will help you be on the path. So the reference point is be interested in where you have either suffering or stress or feelings or sense of unsatisfactoriness, and stop and appreciate that so that you can begin understanding the cause of it. Then the second thing is to begin studying the second noble truth, which is, in what ways are you clinging? What ways are you attached? And then if you can, either let go and experience the cessation of it, or if you can't let go, which is difficult, right, then walk the Eightfold Path. So it begins by view. It begins with an understanding. So what's nice is it's not a metaphysical understanding. It doesn't involve supernatural beings and realities and transcendent realities. It starts with something very ordinary that all human beings encounter, and I think know how to encounter their suffering. Then, in order to walk this path, and part of the character development, is that you want to approach it, the path, or engage in this process of self-discovery and freedom, with useful attitudes, right attitudes, or it's called right intention. There are certain ways of thinking that are more conducive to lead, if you want to become free, there are certain ways of thinking that are more helpful than other ways of thinking. And it's more helpful to have an attitude of compassion than attitudes of cruelty. It's more helpful to have attitudes of kindness than attitudes of hostility. And it's more helpful to think about letting go than it is to be caught up in sensual cravings. So to cultivate attitudes of compassion, to cultivate attitudes of loving kindness and kindness, and to cultivate a willingness to live lightly, to let go, to simplify, to open up, not to hold on so much. These are useful attitudes to have. And so the question is, how do you cultivate and develop those attitudes? How do you develop in such a way that they're sincere, authentic? They're not just kind of covering over what's there and pretending that you're being kind and compassionate. That's the important task of the Eightfold Path. And then with those first two steps, right view and right intention, then we begin walking the path. And in the schema of the Eightfold Path, it begins with our behavior. Because our behavior, what we do, is sometimes easier to get to adjust than what goes on deep in our minds and our hearts. And so if you are involved in killing people, you should stop. And don't do it. If you're involved in stealing, you should really stop. If you want to be free, spiritually free, stop stealing. Stop taking what is not given. If you really want to be spiritually free, don't harm other people with your sexuality. You can't be free if you do that. If you want to be free, stop lying. And if you want, those are the four primary ones. That's in the first. So it's called right action. Not killing, not stealing, not lying, and no sexual misconduct are the third step of the Eightfold Path, right action. I had it a little bit wrong. It's not killing, and no sexual misconduct are considered right action, because not lying and right speech is the next factor of the Eightfold Path. It's a whole factor by itself. So if you want to become free, stop lying. So it's kind of I know these things kind of heavy, and all these requirements of you. With these Buddhists, they have all these obligations and requirements. They're kind of party poopers. You have to stop killing. You have to stop killing, and you have to stop stealing, and it's kind of unfortunate. But anyway, it's the way it is. I think that if you want to be free, that's what it takes. It takes something from you. Requires something from you. And since probably most of you are not involved in killing and stealing in obvious ways, part of the task as we mature is to actually consider these in more subtle ways as well. That we're involved, ways in which somehow we're involved in behavior which causes harm to the world around us. And these right action and right speech, not lying and the other ones, are all ways of starting to live our life so that our lives don't cause harm. A very high requirement in Buddhism for this character development, for this inner cultivation, that sets the conditions there so that we can really look deeply inside of ourselves and do the freeing work, is to live a life that doesn't cause harm. And it's essential for the deeper and deeper levels of, or higher, whatever you call it, higher, deeper levels of the path of Buddhism, because as practice develops, the heart and mind becomes more and more sensitive, more and more refined, and even the subtle movements of causing harm become a clear blockage to the possibility of going further into the realms of freedom. So if you really want to go into freedom, there has to be a life of harmlessness, exploring and developing that. So there's a right action, there's a right speech, and then there's a right livelihood. These are the three kind of behavioral parts of the Eightfold Path. And then the last three parts of the Eightfold Path have to do with the mind, the heart, and beginning to care for that, to cultivate and develop a high quality inner life. And if our inner life is agitated, stressed out, it's very hard to have the clarity to really see deeply into where the attachments are, where the clinging is, and how to let go. And so there's last three factors are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right effort is to make the effort to start being the caretaker for the quality of your heart and mind. And not to... So if you do things, if you have behavior or attitudes or inner intentions, motivations, that clearly are diminishing the quality, the goodness of your inner life, do your best to stop doing those things. And if you know things that enhance the quality of your heart and mind, do those things. So be the caretaker of the quality of your inner life. And don't think big, too big, because it can be quite intimidating. And many people in the West have such strong negative self-opinions that any attempt to talk about look at where you're maybe causing yourself to have a poor quality mind makes you feel even worse, because now I'm a bad person. But the idea is to let go of those tendencies that drag us down and pick up those perspectives, those understandings that lift us up that make us feel happier and lighter, clearer, more settled. So it's a whole art to learning the right effort, to make the shift to be the caretakers of our inner life. To do that really well requires two factors, mindfulness and concentration. Mindfulness is the capacity for heightened self-understanding, self-monitoring, self-awareness. And without greater and greater self-awareness, we can't expect to be able to go deep into the heart to see what's really lodged there and how all this works so we can let go. And then the last is concentration. And concentration, especially concentration and mindfulness together, are such beautiful qualities. In terms of the highest quality of the mind that you can ever attain, short of freedom, is a mind which is luminous, clear, mindful, mindfully equanimous, and concentrated. There's a purity and a pristine quality to awareness, to the mind, when it's deeply, deeply settled, at peace, quiet, still, vibrantly alive, that can't be there if the mind is caught up and agitated by its thoughts, concerns, what I want and what I don't want, how I'm seen, how I don't seen, our resentments, our planning. It's quite a phenomenal thing that the mind has the capacity to get quiet and pure, quiet and unconcerned with anything whatsoever. And that unconcerned mind is kind of like looking into a beautifully still and pure and clean mountain lake where there's no ripples on the surface and no muck in the water, and you can see right down to the bottom. It's so clear. So the same way with our minds. We cultivate and develop ourselves so that we have a good quality, good character, a blameless character. So when we sit down to meditate, there's no agitation there. We can get concentrated and see deeply. And in that clarity of the mind, we can go down right down to the roots of really see what's happening. And that then is, sets the stage for awakening. So this is the path. When the Buddha was first enlightened, when he first started teaching, he came out and he pointed to this as a path of practice to follow. If we follow it, and it takes maybe a while, cultivate our character, cultivate our capacity for insight, for concentration, for stillness, then insight can arise, deeper forms of insight. And the insight that the Buddha had the night of his awakening is described in terms that are very similar to the Four Noble Truths, but are distinct. The night of his awakening, it said that he describes it himself. He says, my mind was still, peaceful, soft, clear, malleable, imperturbable. And with that imperturbable, still, pure mind, I directed my attention to my attachments, my clinging. And I saw this is suffering. This is the arising of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. And this is the means to be free. And this very simple formulation sounds like the Four Noble Truths, but it's not meant to be the Four Noble Truths in the way it's described as a path and things to understand. It's meant to be direct insights into, you see a movement of pain or stress or suffering or anything at all. The same formula is used for all kinds of things. You see it. You see, because things are impermanent, things arise and pass, you see that it arises. And it's quite something to see your attachment, your pain, your suffering, your stress get born. it's quite something to watch a thought get born. Because often we don't, we're kind of operating on the surface of our life or in the generalities of our life. In the same way that if you, teacher in Burma, he said that if you look at a row of ants far in the distance, it looks like a solid line, black line. But if you get close to those ants, you see that they're actually segments, just one little ant and one little ant and one little ant. But the mind has a capacity to kind of generalize and see things as being solid when they're not really solid. And so we live in a life where we feel that our depression, our anger, our resentments, our despair, or whatever's going on for us is solid. Because we haven't actually been able to get still enough and clear enough to see the segmented quality, how it arises and they pass moment by moment. We don't get slow enough. We don't slow the film down enough to see that all there is on the movie screen are still shots. But it's one still shot after another, 16 a second or whatever they do. But the mind has this constructs movement out of it. There's no movement on the screen, right? You know that, right? I hope you know that. When you go to the movies, there's absolutely no movement on the screen. It's your mind that constructs the movement, because it blends everything together. And so we get quiet enough, and a remarkable thing, to see the birth, the arising of suffering, and not just to see it's arising and passing, the arising of a thought, I am something, to arising of an identity. All these things just arise. They're not inherent in the universe, our thoughts, our concerns, what the mind is about, our suffering, to see the birth of it. And then to see, in the wake of that birth, it ceases. It comes to a complete stop. You have a thought, and if we live in our thoughts and assume that our thoughts are true all the time, it's very easy to kind of be blinded by the thoughts, to not realize that a thought is just a thought. And we don't see that, we think that what the thought is about lingers and stays and weighs on us perhaps. But to see a thought being born and to see it cease means we see that in that moment of ceasing, there's nothing there. There's nothing there to oppress us, nothing there to hold on to, nothing, no attachment in that moment. And so that's what the Buddha saw, not just arising and passing of things, he saw the arising and the ceasing. And in that ceasing, there was freedom. In that ceasing, there is no identification. In that ceasing, there is no attachment. In that ceasing, there is radical freedom. And because that was the... having that insight was led him to the experience of freedom. What happens sometimes is when you see the arising and the ceasing fully, it's kind of like in the space after the when things are seized, that gap, that space, that it's kind of like the mind's tendency to hold on to anything. The mind's consciousness lets go of itself. Consciousness itself arises and passes. It's kind of like consciousness is constantly holding on to things, wanting the next thing, wanting the next thing, looking, searching, reacting. But when consciousness doesn't even look for itself, doesn't even hold on to itself, something in our hearts and minds can just drop away radically, fall away. In Zen, they talk about the bottom from the bucket falling open. The floor just drops out. It's a radical falling away of attachments, of clinging, of all kinds of things, even of consciousness, oddly enough. And then the Buddha saw, this is the way to freedom. This is the means. So the teachings on the Four Noble Truths are the understandings and the practices that prepare us for this deep insight of realization, prepares us for this momentary experience, the stillness and the quiet, where we're relaxed, we feel at home, we're at peace, and we can see in the moment, right down to the bottom of the lake. And in that purity and clarity, we can see something arise, a thought arise, an impulse arise, a desire arise. We can see it arise. And we can see that it also ceases totally for a moment. And in that momentary seizing and letting go, there can be a whole dropping away that can happen. That cannot happen if we're constantly wanting the next thing, looking and reacting. And that experience of this radical letting go or freedom that the Buddha experienced was the beginning of a 2,500-year tradition that you're part of. It was a radical experience of transformation that leads to the deepest human capacity for freedom, for peace, and for compassion. So the Eightfold Path. It's a beautiful path. The teaching of the Four Noble Truths are wonderful teachings. And if you're so inclined, if this sounds meaningful to you, you could spend the year hanging out with them, getting to know them better, studying them, exploring them. But remember that if all you do is study them in the books, that it's a little bit like studying the travel books. The idea is to get into the territory. So if you can figure out this year how you can enter the territory of the Eightfold Path and make it your own, then this path is a really good path. And however far the journey takes you, it's a really good journey. No amount of effort is wasted. Okay, so thank you all. Happy New Year.